Blind Cool Tech, January 17th, 2006. Hey y'all, how are you? I'm Larry Skutkan, your host for this edition of Blind Cool Tech, coming to you almost live from Orlando, Florida. That's right, we're at a meeting, a NIMAS meeting, National Instructional Materials Access Center. I've mentioned this on Blind Cool Tech several times. And then Wednesday, tomorrow evening, the ATIA conference opens. That's the Assistive Technology Industry Association. So we'll be bringing you some coverage from that. And I've already got a couple of pretty good interviews lined up that I hope will come through. What I want to do now, though, this NIMAS stuff is very, very exciting, but as with many things, the details of it get rather laborious. But I've selected some parts from this meeting, primarily one about the National Information Materials Access Center, which is a repository that will be administered by APH, American Printing House for the Blind. And what follows is Julia's update to the NIMAS committee about what's going on with the NIMAC.
Good morning, everyone. Since there are a few new people here today, I guess I'll give a very brief update from more or less from the beginning. In December 2004, the American Printing House for the Blind discovered that we had been named in the legislation to establish the National Instructional Materials Access Center at APH. Since then, we've been working with the Department of Education to help us clarify some key definitions and issues related to legislation, some of which Bonnie's indicated that we'll be giving more information on shortly, which includes the group of users, the students who will be covered by this, the definition of print disabled, authorized users of the NIMAC, etc. So we've been working with them. We've also identified and have been working with a technology consultant whose name is Marshall Breeding. He's with Vanderbilt University. We've been talking to vendors who can provide us the systems infrastructure that we need to operate the NIMAC, which is really key to this. We have formed an advisory council, which has met twice now. We have expanded the advisory council. When we met in Dallas, I named the current members of the advisory council, and since then, I believe just last week, in fact, Jim Fruchterman has joined us on the NIMAC advisory council. So that is the latest on that front. On the key issues in terms of the way the precise way that authorized users will have access to the NIMAC, who will be authorized users, and those policies and procedures that we want very much to have nailed down so that we can share in a very concrete and unchanging fashion to everyone. We're not there yet. I think as Bonnie indicated, there is some more information coming from the Department of Education. We have a meeting scheduled with them in early February where we hope finally to have all I's dotted and T's crossed. So this morning I'm not planning on talking a lot about that because it's not nailed down yet, but it should be very close to being so. So if I spelled out for you how we see it operating today and everybody runs with that as this is how it's going to be and goes back to the respective states and organizations and says this is how it's going to work, and then within 2 or 3 weeks it's changed and the official final policies and procedures are out, that doesn't seem very, very helpful. What I can say is that we have, as I mentioned, been working with the vendors to provide the technology that we need to operate the NIMAC. And in fact, just last Friday, we notified Overdrive, Inc. that they are the vendor that we will be partnering with for this. Overdrive, of course, has a website, and it's www.overdrive.com. Steve Potash is the CEO of Overdrive. He's a founding member of the Open eBook Forum and currently a director with that organization. They deliver content now, audio books, e-books. They work also with music and video files. They offer a very secure environment in which to store the files we receive from publishers. In fact, they work with, I believe, over 400 publishers now, including primarily higher education divisions and trade divisions, and most of the publishers that we expect to be working with us to provide the files for the students for the NIMAC, the K-12 material. For example, they are the technology infrastructure that underlies the beta program now of MTP Direct, which is delivering PDF textbooks to college students at a number of universities. They're working with the National Library Service and a number of talking book libraries on an initiative to deliver digital audio books to users who are blind or visually impaired through a pilot project called Unabridged. They work with both the Army and the Navy to deliver audiobooks through secure networks to, say, Iraq and ships at sea. So I think they'll be able to help us out by delivering them in the continental U.S. I think that won't be too challenging for them. They have a great deal of excess capacity already for storage. In terms of the publishers they work with now, because they do work with trade publishers, they do auditing at such a level to support, say, payment of royalties. They have custom DRM solutions available. They accept individual file uploads, batch uploads from publishers. They already do XML validation. They basically, one of the reasons we're going with them as opposed to vendors who suggested building this from scratch is that they already have some tried and true technology in place that provides security, that provides capacity, and that also telling licenses already mid-January, and we need to be up and operational in December of this year. They hope that they'll have the systems ready for us to be fully testing by summer, because they'll be basically modifying systems that they already have rather than building everything for us from scratch. So that is the latest definitive news I can tell you, is that we're planning on working with Overdrive. In terms of actually being able to pay for this yet, we haven't finalized our agreement with the Department of Education, which is key, but those materials should be going into the department this month. And so we're feeling very, very comfortable on the technology side that we're partnered with someone who's going to be able to meet our needs, who's interested, very interested in working with us on accessibility issues, which frankly was an issue that knocked out a couple of other vendors who either felt incapable or were not where we wanted them to be with that. So if you look at Overdrive's website, you look at some of their offerings, they work with the National Library of Singapore. If you go to New York Public Library, they work with them. They should be able to help us support the kind of meta-searching of both LUI, where complete student-ready versions of textbooks are listed, and the NIMAC database, where the source files that can be used to produce those student-ready versions reside. There are a couple of different options. We've considered working with them so that people can get that information, so that someone is not downloading a file for a book that's actually already available somewhere in a format that they already need. Those should be able to accommodate that for us. So that's where we are. We still need to nail down some of the details, obviously, with regard to very key issues related to the operation of the NIMAC with regard to authorized users, the precise policies and procedures with regard to that. We're moving forward, though, with Overdrive. Obviously, some of the issues that are still outstanding, including at least one that I know is on the agenda today, is one that we need to get that information to our vendor so that they can accommodate whichever way we go, for example, with image files. If publishers want to provide us full PDFs, which I think is probably not where we are likely to end up, but if they do, they certainly handle that now. They can handle the kind of DRM that would be necessary if we wanted to pass on full PDFs to those who are going to produce the full, fully accessible textbook in a secure manner, encrypted. They certainly can handle the fingerprinting that we know will include with the files now, so that we can track the files later if files turn out to be used inappropriately in some fashion later, to track those back at a minimum. But there are various levels of DRM that they can offer us. If we have a controlled set of authorized users, they can even provide us IP authentication for those users as a level of security. Again, as they told us, they're working with the military to provide audio books to ships and to servicemen around the globe, and that's a pretty secure environment. Other things that people might be interested in, they do offer 24/7 service that we should be up, the NYMEX should be up and available. They didn't even go down with the last blackout that took out much of the East. Their server farm was still up and operational. So that's about where we are. We're proceeding, I think, I'm very comfortable with the pace and that we will be able to have all the technology pieces in place. We'll do the testing with the publishers and authorized users so that we'll be ready to go in December. And if we can get some of these last details nailed down with regard to the authorized users and some other those remaining issues, and we'll have the policies and procedures out for everybody to be aware of and to build towards. So that's my update.
Thank you very much. This is a good time if anybody has any questions. I don't know if anybody does. But one thing, Julia, you didn't mention was that there's a new NYMEX reference on the APH website. Did I just want to mention that?
Right, thanks. Thanks, Skip. I meant to mention that. The APH website, the American Pediatric Blind website, is www.aph.org. There is now a direct link to information about the NYMEX. It doesn't have a great deal of additional information there now, but it will be updated regularly. And as soon as we get the final information of policies and procedures, that will go up. We'll probably also add a link out to OverDrive and maybe a bit more information about them. But we literally just notified them Friday that we're planning on working with them. So that's not up yet.
Great. Jessica and then Mary, and I just would ask, when you ask your question, just state your name so that help Jen and Linda can track.
This is Jessica Rooney with ATIA. We had a quick opportunity to look over the posting on APH's website, and we have some definite questions and concerns about a few of the things that are there. Rather than making this a big session that gets into the detail, I know that you have a lot of concern about that. Is there an opportunity that you can submit some comment directly at APH and perhaps over the Department of Education as well, so that we can put those issues out there and perhaps they can be addressed in this process forward?
Well, speaking for APH, you can submit the information to me at jmyers@aph.org.
Thank you very much. And you can send it to me. Thank you. Great.
Mary?
Julia, probably a question.
Close to the mic.
I'm sorry. Mary Platner. Question I have for you, and I'm going to test you one. Our state, Arizona, co-authored our state law with the Association of American Publishers with Steve, and I'm surmising Alan was in the background, where we have adopted NYMEX for all disabled kids who qualify through their IEP or Section 504 plan. Can we utilize NYMEX also?
There will be an acceptable use policy that will, right now the definition that we have of students who are qualified is that which is contained in the legislation, which refers to the Act for the Education of the Blind from 1931. Bonnie has indicated that the department may provide some additional information or definition to that, so exactly what that definition may be or if that's going to change based on anything we hear from the Department of Education, I can't say right now, but right now what we have to operate from is the legislation. And so when we draft the acceptable use policy that those who access the NYMEX will need to sign off on, we will, at present, we intend to reference that.
Okay, even though we co-authored it, I know we're a state, but even though we co-authored it with the publishers and signed off on it,
the NYMEX is being established under that piece of legislation, so we have to operate it within the confines of the legislation under IDEA 2004. And that piece of the legislation does provide a definition for those with print disabilities. And so that's what we have to work from in establishing the NYMEX. Obviously, the Department of Education can write regulations. That's part of what their role could be. But I don't have that yet, so I can't speak to what they may or may not choose to write. I can only speak to what the legislation says, and that's what this organization is being set up under.
Okay, thank you.
Can I just offer a clarifying comment here, particularly for new folks? The NYMEX operates under the Chafee Amendment and the earlier one law for the adult blind, which limits the distribution of alternate format material to a subset of students with disabilities. And what Mary is addressing is that the Arizona legislation, for example, challenge because the NIMAC is constrained by Chafee, and Arizona is also committed to a slightly different orientation, as is Kentucky, am I correct?
Yes.
So we have two states where legislation actually extends beyond the federal mandates and the federal exemptions. So I think that that's really a challenge that we being NIMAC centers and this committee is well aware of. There are no immediate easy answers that jump to mind, and I think that clearly forward-thinking states like Kentucky and Arizona have moved proactively to say all students with disabilities need access to accessible instructional materials, and so one way of doing that is legislating. On the other hand, we want to be able to support a market model because currently under the change in distribution, there's no competition for publishers to do that, in that process. So there are a lot of conflicting issues here. There's no easy answer, but I just want to clarify people what the question was that Brian was raising. And I think Julie's right, that we don't have a definitive response right now. But it's something that when those things come up, if you think of something and you get an aha, and perhaps it's that the states that have legislation that goes beyond the Chafee exemption and still want to access information from the NIMAC would then be able to sign an assurance that the NIMAC-related files would actually be delivered to Chafee exempt students. One way of solving that issue, at least aligning with the NIMAC. But it still doesn't solve the bigger issue, which Mary is saying is, well, what if we get these files, but we can't use them with the students for whom our state legislation is coming.
The other thing is, just to reassure the publishers, and I did this very directly with Steve, we are not looking for freebies. We just want access so that teachers and states are not continuously reinventing the wheel, which makes it very shady, because right now teachers are between a rock and a hard place. They need to provide meaningful instruction. We're facing inclusion, especially with highly qualified people needed in high school and to some extent middle school level. Our special ed teachers are highly qualified, but the law requires that they be qualified in the subject area that they're teaching, which means more and more inclusion and more typical regular classroom textbooks.
Jim and Chuck. Chuck and then Jim.
Just for the record, I'd like you to know that the Texas law also authorizes the use of publisher files for any and all of the schools.
Thank you very much for clarifying.
And I'd like to add a comment direct question for you. So, this is Joe Fruchterman of Bochera. I guess my comment is that the NIMAC is going to operate under law and regulation, and schools, education systems, states are going to be signing contracts with publishers. And I hope that the NIMAC, which is going to be dealing pretty much with trusted entities, could basically allow that if a publisher, the owner of intellectual property, agrees to let a state access its content to the NIMAC for these other students, that trusted entity would do that. So I don't know how that might work. I know that it can't be part of the law and regulation, probably, since state would have to prevent. But leave that open, that because I think part of this is to relieve the publisher of the burden of having to put the same material out on several different channels. And then my other question is, Julie, could you recap what this committee could settle or advise that would help you with an IMAC? I think you kind of alluded to some of that, but I want to make sure, if you had a list of two or three things, I wish you guys would settle the English question or whatever it is, that would be very helpful.
Well, for this committee, the image file is the question that I think can settle for us. What format image file will we be receiving so that we can, it's not that the vendor won't be able to accommodate whatever that is, but in terms of building it and meeting our deadlines, we need to give them the actual information of what they're expected to receive so that it can be validated, if nothing else. If it has to be JPEG and PDF is not allowed, then they're going to validate on. That's one of the pieces that will be validated, for example. Doubt that it will work out quite like that. But so, yes, that's the question. Susan.
Thank you. Susan.
Susan Christensen. One of the things that I've talked to Skip about in terms of Braille software
We're planning on testing with publishers. We'll be providing files into the NIMAC, and then the files that are removed from the NIMAC will only be obtained by those who are authorized users of the NIMAC. So those are the people we'll be working with in terms of testing the NIMAC. It seems to me that testing NIMAC files for use with Braille translation software falls a little bit outside of that, and I think then what one would be looking for would be permission from the publishers to hand those files off to, or the publishers themselves can provide them to some group of those who are looking at that issue. But the NIMAC itself is basically, it's, you know, files go in from the publisher and out to the authorized users, and that's what it's going to be built to do. And so for the NIMAC, that's what we'll be doing with the files. I think in terms of looking at files to work with Braille translation software, which is something that APH, as opposed to the NIMAC itself, but APH as opposed to the NIMAC itself, is also very interested in doing. We have talked with publishers about getting NIMAC conformant files so that we can begin testing that with a Braille translation software. But that was done really kind of outside of the NIMAC piece, if you see what I mean. It's not the same.
Of the files that are going to be coming there, which is another process which I don't think I heard mentioned. I think maybe you mentioned validation that would be done in terms of, and I assume you meant there like XML validation. and for those of the non-persuasion. What that basically means is that you can test that the syntax of the file itself is valid, just like you would for, you know, sentences. And just like with sentences, you can have perfectly valid syntax and meaningless prose. So there's the need for testing that the files actually use the syntax in an appropriate manner and that it actually is an appropriate representation of what's in the printed book. And I realize that's a really tough problem because it inevitably involves somebody looking at the book and looking at the files. And I just wanted to know if that, at all that issue is still on the table or is being considered or any kind of mechanisms for feedback from end users that, you know, maybe a file was didn't look right and needs to come back to the publisher.
Before you answer, can I just give a nod? Does everybody understand what James is asking? If you don't, shake your head and I can help clarify, because if I can, okay, finally shake your head. So the question really is it possible, is there a mechanism set up for validating the files that are being submitted? So within an XML file, could you give an example of an error, James, and like a sentence tag inside of
it? Yeah, well, you know, there's the format says you've got to have, you know, you can't have a heading in the middle of a paragraph, for example. That just doesn't, that's not allowed because that's poor syntax. So if that happened, it would throw out an error there. However, if there was something that's clearly marked as a heading in the book and the publisher didn't put that in as a heading in the file, for some reason, they, you know, they marked it as a paragraph, but it's really a heading. That's something that you can't, in an automated mechanical way, test. Somebody has to look and say, well, that's not appropriate, that's not a paragraph, that's really a heading. And that's the kind of quality issue that is going to, there needs to be some kind of mechanism of some sort to address those kind of problems, because they will inevitably happen, because that's, you know, the nature of work is that people screw it up occasionally.
And to follow on that, if we do it up front, then it doesn't have to be done time and time again by each organization that's drawing on those files. Otherwise, everybody's going to have to do quality control at their own shop, and that would lead to delays.
Thank you.
No. Should I expand on that just a little bit?
Yeah, just a hint.
Because you aren't going to like the answer. But no, it is going to be primarily an automatic validation. There will be human monitoring to make sure that we have the file that it purports to be, that it passes the validation steps, that it looks complete. We actually do not expect to receive or have access to the full textbook, so even if there weren't real issues with just how long it would take us to make that file available, then if we had someone eyeballing the textbook page by page and word for word and comparing that to the file, we're not going to have the means to do that anyway. So no, that won't be occurring at the NIMAC. It'll be primarily automatic validation with human beings actually looking to make sure that what passed the validation, all the validation mechanisms work, and it will be the XML that will need to be validated. It will also need to be the Dublin Core metadata that come with it. We need to be sure that information is correct. And but no, the level, I understand why you'd be interested in that and why many people would be, but that isn't going to occur at the NIMAC. That's not, it's not practical because we're not going to have what we would need to do in order to be able to do that in the first place. And in the second place, the way we've conceived of the NIMAC and looked at the legislation with its goal being to expedite the standard format files delivery to those who are actually going to be working with them and producing fully accessible textbooks. And as part of those processes, the kind of quality check that you're talking about has to take place anyway. So, no, in order to make sure that we make those files available and as quickly as we can, it's going to be as automated a process as possible.
Yeah, just to follow with that, I kind of anticipated that that answer because you're exactly right. I mean, it's obviously something that, you know, it's not feasible for you guys to look at every book. However, I would encourage, sort of get my feedback in here, to think about a kind of a feedback process from the field back to the library. In other words, if you get a book in there and there does turn out to be something wrong, is there going to be a way for somebody to report back that there was a problem with the file, it wasn't what they were expecting, it was something incorrect about it? That
yes.
kind of thing is likely to happen, and that's a way to get some of that in there so it's not, you know, if a bad file is identified, there's a way to repair it.
Yes, the answer to that is yes.
Oh, yeah, good. Yeah. One yes. Okay. Is that consensus building?
It's actually, it's kind of dying.
What we had been discussing was not to limit files provided in the NIMAS format to the NIMAC to only the educational agency that contracted with the publisher, but that they would be available to any who would
so
be authorized to
use. Once someone has made the purchase, let's say, and they, or voluntarily someone has delivered the file, it will then become available to any
authorized user of the NIMAC. And our thinking is that that's going to be a very tightly controlled group of those who are charged by their educational agencies, at the, particularly at the state level, to provide accessible textbooks to students K through 12 with qualifying disabilities in their state.
Charlie, this is good. Let me just ask you the begging concern behind the question, which is your concern that
also, actually, if a sale of that has been only made to one state, I mean, the number of students with a qualifying disability are always going to be very, very small in any one of those states. A state that where the school district or state or whatever level the books or textbooks are selected state by state adopts that would have, I mean, they're not going to have their blind, visually impaired, or print-disabled student, hopefully using a textbook from one publisher, and then the rest of the students in class, a textbook from a completely different publisher, hopefully. That's part of, you know. So that concern, if it's being used within that state for a student with a qualifying disability, then those textbooks, the regular print version of those textbooks, presumably have been purchased by an agency there at some level for those students. So that even though it went in because an educational agency in one state contracted for it to be of use to people in another state, someone in that state is going to have to have contracted with the publisher for X copies of that instructional material as well, and they happen to need one copy that's in an accessible format. So, and then again, also may I say just one final thing. Of course, there are different accessible formats, of course, but the other thing, because of scarce resources that we're very anxious in accomplishing with this, is that once that source file, which after all is not what you're going to want to hand off to the student, has been turned into a fully accessible textbook, that it's listed as available for sale, for free, however, from the agency who's converted it into Braille or the audiobook or whatever, they can find that, then they don't have to do that work all over again. So in that scenario, they may not be going to the NIMAC for the file anyway. They'll be going to the provider of the fully accessible textbook that they can just hand to their student without doing any incremental work.